General Moore, Reel One. Can you tell me, General, how it was that the Falklands crisis first impinged on you personally?
Yes, I can. It's quite an amusing little tale, in a way. Because it shouldn't have impinged upon me personally at all, had things gone according to plan. You recall in October 1981, the IRA attempted to murder my boss, General Sir Stuart Pringle. And so when he went into hospital, I, being the next senior guy around, took nominal command of the Corps. I didn't, in fact, leave my job in Plymouth, but I did certain of his duties, and his chief of staff did other of his duties, but I was technically commanding the Corps from then until he returned from hospital. So that I was not able to act according to my predicted timetable and hand over my job in Plymouth on the 4th of February to go on retirement leave. Thus, when General Pringle came back and resumed command of the Corps on the 31st of March, 82, he called a meeting of his generals, appropriately enough, on the morning of the 1st of April, to discuss the way ahead and how we would proceed with things now that he was back. Now, at that meeting, we did discuss the South Atlantic, because, of course, the Corps has had for many years a small detachment in the Falkland Islands, and we had been aware, obviously, with the Davidoff business in South Georgia, and with intelligence reports of one sort and another, that something was cooking. The extent to which the government's knowledge of how far it was going or what the plans were, I don't know and didn't know at the time. But it was quite obvious that people were beginning to think of possible actions to protect the islands or to prevent an invasion, which was obviously seen as a possibility. And a number of suggestions were put to us about what we might do about it. Could we provide a unit to go south? Yes, of course we could. That's our business. And various thoughts, I remember, being put. One was to recall a commando from leave because they might be needed, but nobody must know about it. Well, how do you recall 650 chaps from leave without their wives and the local police and so on knowing? Not possible. Another which tickled our senses of the ridiculous was that there was a suggestion one time that maybe we ought to send our air defence troop. And it was a nice thought to consider how the Argentinians would view 54 young men with short haircuts and big boots, every single one of them carrying a double bass case, because how else would you get your missiles there? Through Buenos Aires Airport, because that was the only way to get to the islands. And, of course, that one was dropped too. So the whole thing was not entirely out of the blue, as it were, but it had really been on a fairly low level, and these sort of possibilities had been floated and had never come to anything. And after the 1st of April meeting, I returned to Plymouth. I got back, as far as I can recall, about 11 o'clock at night or something. Had some things to do, and so I went and dealt with a few papers ready for the morning in my study. And went to bed about 1:30, and then it was 2:30 the telephone went, and the chief of staff to the Commandant General had rung me to say I'd better go down to the office, because it was quite clear that an invasion was imminent and was on its way. So I went down to the office and I rang him back and said, you do remember that yesterday was the 1st of April, not today. So that was the first thing. It was not totally out of the blue, but it was unexpected. It was quite clear that that was going to change things. But the extent to which they were going to be changed And I'm really talking about the personal aspect of it rather than anything about national policy or anything, was not clear to start with how long it would last. None of us had any idea, therefore how it would affect my plans. I had no idea. At the 1st of April meeting, we decided that I would now hand over my job to the Chief of Staff on the 4th of May. So there was, you know, a month to go while he sorted out and handed over the Chief of Staff's job in London to come down to take over from me. So when things blew, and I became obviously very active, and I'll come back to that in a minute, there was in the background still this date of the 4th of May, and after the first couple of days, when we were too busy to consider any such thing, I did drop in the word with them in London that we'd better consider about this matter. Was the thing going beyond the 4th of May, in which case did they want me to stay around or whatever, or would I hand over anyway? Clearly, I didn't expect them to give me an answer on the telephone there and then, but it was a thing we had to think about, and we did talk about it. And one was in the ridiculous position of looking for civilian jobs at the same time. And some weeks after the thing started, while I was working up at Northwood with the Commander-in-Chief, I was going away for job interviews. And I went for one job interview just after I'd appeared on breakfast television or something, and not surprisingly, the people I went for the interview bored with said, "Are you serious about applying for this job?" And in fact, after a while, in that particular case, I did, in the end, you know, get back to them and say, "I think I must withdraw from it. It does look as if this thing might well go on for a while, and I don't think I can stay in contention." And I did, in fact, drop the business of looking for civilian jobs. But for the first few weeks, that was still going on.
How much did you know about the so-called scrap merchants on South Georgia?
I knew what I read in the newspapers, much the same as everybody else. I don't think, really, in my recollection, we knew much more about them than that. Whether the intelligence community did actually know anything in any more detail, I don't know. I rather doubt it, actually, but I'm not qualified to say whether they did. Perhaps we might now go on, if it suits you, with then what might be quite interesting in a way is that my involvement, of course, with the Falkland campaign came in three quite distinct parts. Part one, week one, was the mounting of the amphibious task force, in which I was doing my normal UK oblique NATO job of mounting the UK-Netherlands amphibious force, less the Netherlands element, but reinforced with first one and later two parachute battalion groups, to go to war. And it was just the same job as I'd been planning for and doing for the last few years. The difference was, of course, the ships sailed out of Plymouth or wherever and turned left instead of right. And they had a heck of a lot further to go. But it was doing the same thing. And it was a very interesting week, that. And I think it was, I find it particularly interesting for two reasons. The first reason was that because I'd been in Plymouth for my last two jobs, first commanding 3 Commander Brigade, and then in Commando Forces. So I'd been there since early 1977, and I'd been there from the beginning of the time that 3 Commando Brigade, as opposed to just 45 Commando Group, was committed to the Arctic role and the Northern European Command reinforcement role. And I'd first of all had my time commanding the brigade with responsibility, if you like, for the tactical employment and the training for that tactical employment of that amphibious force. Then I had moved from there to commando forces via, I may say, an interregnum of about 6 months, in which I did considerable further study on the detail of the employment and what it was the Northern European commanders wanted of 3 Commando Brigade, and what 3 Commando Brigade, UK, Netherlands, Amphibious Force, could offer, and trying to make sure that we really were matching the two and that there were no misunderstandings about it. And it was an interesting time, that, in a NATO context. And then, as Major General Commando Forces, one was responsible for their mounting and their backup and everything else, and all the logistic support that went with that. And one was responsible, too, for the liaison with our own fleet headquarters and SACLANT's headquarters.
Which headquarters?
SACLANT, Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic, over in Norfolk, Virginia. Because we were then SACLANT troops. So all of that was very interesting, and we had worked very hard at it, and I think reasonably quickly, at the business of getting our plans forwarded and the logistic backup actually worked out, earmarked, exercised and everything. And we'd done our series of exercises, as one always does, from the low level upwards. And we'd taken, for instance, the mounting of the force through to actually exercising really quite extensively the logistic backup of the force on operations, so that we moved ammunition and stores out of the base depots in the United Kingdom and moved them to the mounting ports, got them into the shipping and moved them off and landed them again and took them forward for usage. And we had established, to give you an example, a complete first line of sand-filled ammunition boxes in the ammunition depots. And every other year we took the whole lot out and put it through the whole cycle of reinforcement and things. So we'd gone quite far along the line of these exercises and being able to iron out inconsistencies or whatever and make sure they were working. But the one thing that we had not done, and that was a concern to me, was to exercise doing all this ourselves at the same time as the fleet was mounting and was taking on board all its ammunition and torpedoes and everything else, after all, through the same ports, to a considerable degree. So, in a way, after all this planning and everything, the Falklands thing came as a final exercise, as it were, in the mounting, because the Navy were now doing it. And it was very satisfying that it did, in fact, work. And my goodness, I think that you could hardly have had a better proving of whether our logistic system would work than the Falkland operation. If it would work there, my goodness, it ought to work at the much shorter range to North Norway. So that was one aspect of that first week, which was very interesting and stimulating. The second was that week was perhaps one of the most exciting in my entire service. Many people might find it odd to say that a week of just sort of terrific rush and an immense amount to do, as everybody would see, but no actual, as it were, action, I describe as exciting, but it really was. There was an electrifying atmosphere, and it dawned on one as the week went on that the electrifying atmosphere was not merely in me and among my headquarters and the troops that I was responsible for, but one could see it right through the population. And I remember that first week of April 1982 as an incredibly sunny week. It was a bright, sunny week. Now, actually, physically, it wasn't. It was a fairly typical April week. And, for instance, the day I saw the Commander 3 Commando Brigade and his staff off to go on board HMS Fearless. It was so thick and foggy, we wondered whether the helicopters would ever appear. But the atmosphere was of this tremendous, exciting, sunshine, bright, cheerful day, and so on. So, very interesting week.
When you talk about the feeling in the population, do you mean that there was a feeling of national purpose and unity?
Yes, yes. That we really did have backing. I mean, one had lived through the years when one always worried. I believe, in fact, that the armed forces have had very good support from the population as a whole and have been supported in, you know, morally supported, as it were. And people have, generally speaking, believed in what we were doing. But it wasn't very apparent in the press often. And there were moments when one felt that maybe one was being got at and so on. Not that week. It was so abundantly clear that everybody did. And I went down to Southampton Docks and I saw Canberra being torn apart and all the people who work in the docks in Southampton, you know, the cheerful way they were going about it and working incredibly hard. And the people moving things on the railways and the TA soldiers who came in for the entire weekend to drive their lorries to move our stuff. And everything like that. It was just a general atmosphere as one went around, and people would almost, you know, just smile at you because you were a chap in uniform. The sense of purpose, yes, I think, was very, very strong. So then we move on to phase two. In phase two, I moved up to the fleet headquarters at Northwood to be land deputy to the Commander-in-Chief Fleet, who, as you know, had been nominated the commander of the task force. Now, this is interesting, first of all, because there was no formal arrangement and there was no formal position for me in the Fleet headquarters. But throughout my time in Commando Forces, I had always been particularly conscious that we, in our role, and our NATO role particularly, as an amphibious force, were part of the naval effort, naval war effort. And I had, both with the previous Commander-in-Chief, who was Admiral Eberle, and with Admiral Fieldhouse, always been very keen to participate in things in the fleet headquarters and to get there to talk to them, myself and my staff with their staff, about things so that we were running along the same track. We are, after all, as an amphibious force, very much a naval asset. And the battle in the North Atlantic, I have always seen very much as a naval battle, rather than a shore battle supported by the sea. The point of North Norway, its significance, is how it affects the North Atlantic battle and the North Sea battles. It had seemed to me very important that we have a really good liaison with the fleet headquarters. Now, I'm not suggesting that either other people hadn't seen that too. I'm just describing my attitude to it. In fact, both commanders-in-chief also, I believe, were very keen on it and were certainly very supportive of any effort I made in that direction. We had been very much tied up and involved with the SAC-LANT headquarters in Norfolk, Virginia, and with the headquarters of the Fleet Marine Force Atlantic, who were there as well, but not in the same situation as us. So, when we were mounting out, it was not surprising that in the first week, very early on, I can't remember whether I telephoned the Commander-in-Chief first or he telephoned me, but I went up to the Fleet headquarters very early on and discussed things with him. And even in the first couple of days, he said, if this thing develops, I am going to need a land deputy. I think you're the guy to do it. How does it strike you? And it seemed to me, of course, that I was totally the logical choice. One, I was the commander of and had been responsible for the amphibious force. Two, a land deputy who is a marine is, by the nature of his background, the right person to go and be the chap who advises the commander-in-chief about the employment of land forces in an amphibious role and in what is essentially a maritime operation. And the Falklands was, of course, essentially a maritime operation. I would say perhaps a classic example of the naval projection of power onto shore. So it all was entirely right, it seemed to me, though it had never been properly planned, that I should move up as land deputy. So, after the first week of the mounting out, I did indeed move to northward on the 9th. And I took the operational elements of my staff with me. I left the logistic elements down in Plymouth with a liaison member from that staff up in Northwood because all the contacts were more readily available to obtain what was needed logistically if they remained based in Plymouth. We moved in and the fleet gave us a part of the headquarters and I set up my staff down there and became part of the Commander-in-Chief's team. So that I found, again, a most interesting, wearing experience. And I think there must be many things to be talked about over that 6 weeks that I was there. And I think the first one, because of course it's, after all, always seen as the first of the principles of war and all the rest of it, it was about our aim, the mission. Now, from where I sat in the very interesting position of not only being part of the command team that ran the operation, the fleet headquarters with the Commander Task Force, Admiral Fieldhouse, I, as his land deputy, his general, was part of that team. And it was very interesting to see how the mission did, in fact, in the event, develop. It is so easy for people who look at these things to say, okay, it was quite clear we had to repossess these islands, so why were the ships not loaded this way, and all sorts of consequential things that come later in the sequence that one would love to have been able to get right from the start. But, of course, we all know, really, that life is not like that. And what I'm saying is that the situation I was in, it was very interesting to observe it. Now, it seems to me that the national aim was absolutely clear right from the day the Argentinians took the islands. I believe that the national aim was seen by the War Cabinet, which was not even formed at that stage, but was within a few days, was to obtain the repossession of those islands, to remove the Argentinian presence before we could begin to start talking about the future. But, of course, that is not the way it presented itself when it got to our level. Because the first thing we were required to do was to sail a task force. And you will recall that the Argentinian invasion took place on, I think it was the Friday, and was it not early the Monday morning two carriers sailed from Portsmouth? I wouldn't guarantee I'm right, but I think it was the Monday. Certainly it was within about 3 days, and within 5 days the amphibious force basically had sailed. Other bits went later to join it. But the point was speed in getting this force away. Now, it seems to me that the purpose of that was absolutely right, in that if the government of this country could demonstrate to the Argentinians that we had the intent, the serious intent to do something about it, they might take a step back and say, you know, we've bitten off more than we can chew, maybe we should withdraw. And I believe that was a perfectly reasonable, logical and proper decision for the government to make. But of course the consequence of it was that the aim given us was simply to sail the task force. We all knew that it was connected with the Falkland Islands, but the essential element was speed. It was not being ready for a landing in this area to face an enemy of this size and to fight battles ashore. We had no idea what the size of the garrison would be by the time we got there, for heaven's sake. We had no idea whether we were even going to have to do a landing. Whether, if we did have to do a landing, it would be with a view to fighting a major battle, or it would be some sort of token. Those were political decisions, which the government couldn't take at that stage, and therefore our mission was simply to sail the task force, and that led to a particular plan which was set off. Now, having dealt with that, and obviously taken account of the fact that the purpose of any such landing, as far as we as military men were concerned, must be to do a landing in the end, we clearly did the best we could. But we were always conscious that there were going to be changes of plan which were going to mean that if we were going to do something in a balanced way, we were going to have to do some rethinking and therefore reordering and restowing of ships and all that sort of thing. And of course, the range being the length it was, we had the convenience of the necessity for a stop somewhere on the way, and that was Ascension, as we know. Things then moved on, and of course we got instructions then to plan for a landing. And I and my staff were working, together with the Commander-in-Chief staff, were working on plans